Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
In the limelight.
Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. lawmakers slammed for double standard on Russia and the Zionist regime crimes against Palestinians. Here's the story. Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Yusuf Monayer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., told Politico, "We are watching at this moment a really horrific set of violations of international law and human rights in Ukraine, and we are seeing an international response that is unified, robust, and also completely hypocritical." Monayer, who supports the nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, BDS, for Palestinian rights, stressed that Russia should be held accountable for its invasion of Ukraine, while noting the disparate treatment by U.S. lawmakers of Palestinians and Ukrainians resisting aggression. Members of Congress have shown their hypocrisy on this issue by supporting anti-BDS legislation when it comes to demanding accountability for Israel's human rights violations, he said. But now they're all for these kinds of efforts targeting Russia. Before Russian troops even invaded Ukraine, lawmakers from both parties supported stringent sanctions in response to what Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Menendez called Russia's brazen violation of international law for declaring Moscow-backed enclaves in Donetsk and Luhansk independent. The Zionist regime's actions constitute flagrant violations of international law, according to prominent international organizations and human rights groups. The nearly 55-year occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds, and construction and expansion of exclusively Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities, the blockade of Gaza, the killing and a wounding of civilians during military operations, ranging from wars to protest suppression, and other policies and actions, including what prominent Israeli regime and international rights groups call apartheid, all run afoul of international law. As the Biden administration, an overwhelming majority in both houses of Congress support severe sanctions targeting the Russian government and economy, they remain steadfast supporters of the fake regime of Israel, which receives $3.8 billion in unconditional annual U.S. aid, and vocal opponents of efforts to boycott the nation. In 2019, House members approved a resolution condemning BDS by a vote of 398-17. Recently, Representative Lee Zeldin reintroduced the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which in a previous iteration threatened violations with up to $1 million in fines and as many as 20 years imprisonment. On the same day, he called for an immediate end to Russian oil imports. Politico fellow Joseph Gideon noted recently that while U.S. politicians have jumped over themselves to sanction Russia back to Stone Age, widespread anti-BDS sentiment among politicians has advocates iced out of public debate. Khaled El Gindi, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, told Politico that the U.S. has sanctions against many countries that haven't invaded their neighbors. But whereas the international community mobilized swiftly to confront Russia's occupation of Ukraine, it has done very little to roll back Israel's occupation. It's exactly this lack of any real accountability or constraints on Israel that ultimately led to BDS movement, he added.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to your program for a better life with me, Javed Akberi. Well, we are living at a time when we do not have access to the prophets and their noble successors. Of course, the door of knowledge and revelation is sealed. We no longer have access to the noble prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and nor do we have access to the companions of the holy prophet, peace be upon him. Therefore, the scholars are there to explain and to elaborate on the teachings of the Holy Prophet and also on the Quranic verses and the Quranic teachings. The question which may come up to our mind is, who is responsible to guide the Ummah and who should take the responsibility? Now, in the absence of the Holy Prophet and in the absence of the Immaculate Imams, of course, who is responsible for the purification of the human society from corruption and from moral vices, from indecency, from anything that corrupts the society? What have God and His Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said in this respect? Is it the duty of religious scholars to take the matters into their hands? Is it the duty of the fuqaha or the scholars of ethics to undertake this important responsibility? The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, has said, رَحْمَ خُلَفَائِي فَقِيلَ يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ مَنْ خُلَفَاؤُكَ قَالَ الَّذِينَ يَحْيَوْنَ سُنَّتِي وَيُعَلِّمُونَهَا عِبَادَ اللَّهِ. The literal translation of this hadith is this: may Allah have mercy on my successors. And it was asked, who are your successors or caliphs? The Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said, those who revive my sunnah and teach it to God's servants. Now, there is no explicit reference to the concept of purification in this hadith. It doesn't say that, okay, it is the responsibility of the scholars to purify the society from corruption or from moral vices. But there is no doubt that purification of the human soul and purification of the human society must be based squarely on religious and divine teachings. And it is understood from this hadith that it is actually the duty of scholars to shed light on religious teachings. It is the duty of scholars to elaborate on the Quranic verses, to explain the Quranic verses to people. It is the duty of the scholars to provide light and to shed light on the teachings of the Holy Prophet and also the Quranic verses, because we understand that the Quran and the prophetic teachings are the most important sources of guidance, the most important sources for the derivation of Islamic laws, for the Islamic laws in general. So the Prophet's Sunnah is not only about teaching, but it is a combination of teaching and a combination of codes and moral advice. And these teachings are aimed at purifying the society, at guiding the humanity towards the right path. Verse 164 of chapter 3 clearly states that Allah actually conferred benefit upon the believers when He raised among them a messenger from among themselves, reciting to them His communications and purifying them and teaching them the book and the wisdom, although before that they were surely in manifest error. Okay. So, إِذْ بَعْثَ فِيهِمْ رَسُولًا مِّنْ أَنفُسِهِمْ, of course, it clearly suggests that the Prophet was sent forth from within the people, from the community of Arabs themselves. The Prophet was sent forth not from somewhere else. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The Prophet was not a supernatural being. The Prophet was not someone from outside. The Prophet was sent from the people themselves. Now, the Prophet came from Arab, and the people were most misguided, misled, and indulged in corruption and mischiefs. The Prophet came from the people to guide those people. So the Prophet was sent forth to recite for them the verses of Allah, the verses to speak about the signs of Allah, وَيَزَكِيهِمْ. And then the Prophet was sent to purify those people, وَيُعَلِّمُهُ الْكِتَابَ, and then, you know, teach them the book, teach them wisdom. And they were the ones who were in error, clearly in error. They were the ones who were misguided. So we see, brothers and sisters, that teaching and purification are interlinked, you know, purification of the soul. In order for us to purify ourselves, we need to understand how to purify ourselves, how to make ourselves pure and cleansed from impurity. Now, teachings and purification are interlinked in the sense that because purification must take place in accordance with Islamic teachings and with what Allah has said, purification cannot occur and cannot be achieved without relying on the teachings of the Holy Quran and without relying on the teachings of the Prophet. For example, the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, clearly indicates and suggests that you Muslims should practice your religion in the same way as I do. And when it comes to, for example, prayer, you should pray in the same way as I pray. Do not add to the religion, do not add to the prayer what is not part of the religion. Do not make the religion difficult for yourselves. Purification of the soul will not take place without following the teachings of the Holy Prophet, without adhering to the teachings of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. The reviving of the Prophet's Sunnah is a duty of Muslim scholars. And this verse also, and the verse, the hadith that I also recited, clearly suggest that the reviving of the Prophet's Sunnah and God's Ayat is a duty of Muslim scholars, and they should teach and help people purify themselves. In this time around, which is the time of major occultation, in which there is, for example, in which the Imam is in his greater occultation, we don't have access to him. He is alive, he is present, and he will reappear sooner, inshallah. As long as the Imam is in occultation, of course, it is the duty of scholars to help Muslims purify themselves and to help purify the society and to help achieve perfection and to help achieve a happy life and a better life. You know, the teachings of the Prophet and achieving perfection and achieving a better life are two concepts that go together with each other. Practically, in the absence of the Imams and the absence of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, of course, it is the duty of the clerical institution, it is the duty of seminaries, and the duty of the Muslim scholars to undertake their responsibility of purifying people and the society from impurities. There is no borderline between teaching, you know, and purification. So the scholars are the ones whom we should refer to and whom we should consult in matters related to the religion. The scholars are the ones who actually represent the Prophet, who represent the Imams, and who are the ones who are responsible for teaching, for instruction, and for guidance of the Muslim community and the Muslim Ummah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. At the core of the theory of a possible criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump is the argument that he knew he had lost the election and sought to overturn it anyway. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled "Panel Suggests Trump Knew He'd Lost the Election, Eyeing Criminal Case." Shortly after the 2020 presidential election, as ballots were still being counted, the top data expert in President Donald J. Trump's re-election campaign told him bluntly that he was going to lose. In the weeks that followed, as Donald Trump continued to insist that he had won, a senior Justice Department official told him repeatedly that his claims of widespread voting fraud were meritless, ultimately warning him that they would hurt the country. Those concerns were echoed by the top White House lawyer, who told the president that he would be entering into a murder-suicide pact if he continued to pursue extreme plans to try to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Yet, Mr. Trump time and again discounted the facts, the data, and many of his own advisers as he continued to promote the lie of a stolen election. According to hundreds of pages of exhibits, interview transcripts, and email correspondence assembled by the House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack for a legal filing released late on Wednesday, 9th of March. In laying out the account, the panel revealed the basis of what its investigators believe could be a criminal case against Donald Trump. At its core is the argument that, in repeatedly rejecting the truth that he had lost the 2020 election, including the assertions of his own campaign aides, White House lawyers, two successive attorneys general, and federal investigators, Donald Trump was not just being stubborn or ignorant about his defeat, he was knowingly perpetrating a fraud on the United States. It is a bold claim that could be difficult to back up in a court of law, but in making it, the House Committee has compiled an elaborate narrative of Mr. Trump's extraordinary efforts to cling on to power. In it, Donald Trump emerges as a man unable or unwilling to listen to his own advisers, even as they explain to him that he has lost the election, and his multiple and varied claims to the contrary are not grounded in fact. At one point, Donald Trump did not seem to care whether there was any evidence to support his claims of election fraud and questioned why he should not push for even more extreme steps, such as replacing the acting Attorney General to challenge his loss. The president said something to the effect of, "What do I have to lose? If I do this, what do I have to lose?" Richard Donahue, a former top Justice Department official, told the committee in an interview. And I said, "Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. Is this really how you want your administration to end? You're going to hurt the country." Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, also tried to get Donald Trump to stop pursuing baseless claims of election fraud. He pushed back against a plan from a rogue Justice Department lawyer, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to distribute official letters to multiple state legislatures, falsely alerting them that the election may have been stolen and urging them to reconsider certified election results. That letter is a murder-suicide pact, Mr. Cipollone told Donald Trump, according to Mr. Donahue. It's going to damage everyone who touches it, and we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again. The account is part of a court filing in a civil case in California, in which the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against the former president. They said they had evidence demonstrating that Donald Trump, the lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding of Congress, conspiracy to defraud the American people, and common law fraud. The committee's filing shows how some of Donald Trump's aides and advisers repeatedly and passionately tried to get him to back down from his various false claims and plans to try to stay in power. It started almost immediately after the polls closed in November of 2020, when members of Donald Trump's campaign data team began trying to break through to the president to impress upon him that he had been defeated. During a conversation in the Oval Office, Donald Trump's lead campaign data guru delivered to the president in pretty blunt terms that he was going to lose, Jason Miller, another top campaign aide, told the House panel. The president said he disagreed with the data expert's analysis, Mr. Miller said, because he thought he could win in courts of law. Jason Miller also told the committee that he agreed with Attorney General William Barr's analysis that there had not been widespread fraud in the election, and said that to the president on multiple occasions, the panel wrote in its court filing. In the chaotic post-election period, Donald Trump's legal team set up a hotline for fraud allegations and was flooded with unverified accounts from people across the country who claimed they had evidence of fraud. A Postal Service truck driver from Pennsylvania asserted, without evidence, that his 18-wheeler had been filled with phony ballots. Republican voters in Arizona complained that some of their ballots had not been counted because they used Sharpie pens that could not be read by voting machines. Mr. Trump appeared to be aware of many of these reports and would speak about them often with aides and officials, raising various theories about voting fraud even as they debunked them one by one. When you gave him a very direct answer on one of them, he wouldn't fight us on it, Mr. Donahue, the Justice Department official, told the House committee, but he would move on to another allegation. Mr. Donahue recalled, for instance, how he told Donald Trump that Justice Department investigators had looked into and ultimately discounted a claim that election officials in Atlanta, Georgia, had wheeled a suitcase full of phony ballots into their counting room on election day. Instead of accepting Mr. Donahue's account, Donald Trump abruptly switched subjects and asked about double voting and dead people voting, then moved on to a completely different claim about how, he said, Indians are getting paid to vote on Native American reservations. After Mr. Donahue sought to knock down those complaints as well, he told the committee, Donald Trump changed topics again and wondered aloud why his numerous legal challenges to the election had not worked. Jeffrey Rosen, another top Justice Department lawyer who became the acting Attorney General after William Barr left the agency, fielded this question, according to Mr. Donahue's account, telling the president that he was free to bring lawsuits but that the department could not be involved. Even though none of Donald Trump's persistent claims about election fraud turned out to be true, prosecutors will most likely have to grapple with the question of his state of mind at the time, specifically the issue of whether he believed the claims were true, said Alan Rosenstein, a former Justice Department official who teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. Alan Rosenstein said, to the extent that the prosecutors had to show intent, Trump's delusion makes that harder. A finder of fact could conclude that Donald Trump is so uniquely narcissistic and self-absorbed that he actually thought the election had been stolen. Throughout December, Mr. Rosen and Mr. Donahue repeatedly informed Donald Trump that both his specific and general claims of election fraud were false. At a White House meeting on 15th of December 2020, Donald Trump was told that people are telling you things that are not right, the committee said. Mr. Donahue personally informed Donald Trump during a 27th of December phone call in very clear terms that the Justice Department had done dozens of investigations, hundreds of interviews, had looked at Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, and concluded that the major allegations are not supported by evidence. The House panel also found evidence that some of the allies most deeply involved in Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his loss were aware that their endeavor lacked legal merit. Mr. Eastman, the conservative lawyer who advised Donald Trump that Vice President Mike Pence could throw out election votes from states he had lost, conceded during a conversation with Mr. Pence's top lawyer, Greg Jacob, that his arguments carried no legal weight and would fail before the Supreme Court. A rejection of electors by the vice president would be a relatively minor violation of federal law, Mr. Eastman acknowledged, agreeing with Mr. Jacobs' assessment that even the most conservative justices would reject it. If this case got to the Supreme Court, we'd lose 9-0, wouldn't we? Mr. Jacob recalled telling Mr. Eastman, according to his interview with the House committee. And he started out at 7-2, and I said, who are the two? And he said, well, I think maybe Clarence Thomas. And I said, really? Clarence Thomas? And so we went through a few Thomas opinions, and finally he acknowledged, yeah, all right, it would be 9-0. The committee recently received documents from the National Archives that showed some of Donald Trump's activities on 6th of January 2021. Among them were a morning meeting that included his eldest son's fiancée, Kimberly Guilfoyle, who has turned over 110 pages of documents to the House committee and was issued a subpoena on Thursday, a call with former Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, and a call with Mike Pence, as he tried to persuade the vice president to go along with his plans. More than 150 police officers would be injured during the mob violence that would cost several people their lives. At 4:45 p.m., with the Capitol still under attack, on 6th of January 2021, Mr. Eastman wrote to Mr. Jacob, "When this is over, we should have a good bottle of wine and a nice dinner someplace."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of having a quality food. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the importance of the use of the quality food. When we talk about the quality food, definitely we talk about the healthy food, which is being said in the Quran and in the teachings of Islam. In today's world, we can see that our kids and our own selves, obviously, because we do not have enough time, we go to work, sometimes like we have kids going to the college, to the school, maybe we are working at the same time. Because of the shortage of time, we many times use junk food. We just buy a sandwich. We just buy chips and burger, for example, and the other types of the fast food, which is like pizza and all other things that we can see in today's world that we are used to, and we get used to in eating these things. And other than this, if we want to have food, unfortunately, most of us do not know how to make a good food, a healthy food, and therefore we are not ready to spend some time for ourselves in order to make a good food. Whereas it is important, according to the Islamic teachings, that you should know that what you eat has impact on you. It has effect on you. Therefore, when I'm looking for myself, when I'm looking into a mirror, and for example, making my dress right, combing my hairs, similarly, when I want to eat something, I should look at my plate. What am I eating? I should look at my dinner table. What is ready for me to eat? is it healthy or not? Because Islam gives importance to this. Islam says if you want to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to have a quality food. It is necessary to have a healthy food, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of the use of a quality food. We said that unfortunately in today's world, we can see like people are using junk food. They do not have time to cook food at home. And on top of that, they do not know what to cook and what to make for themselves. And therefore, that's why we can see that when such a pandemic like Corona or COVID, when it attacks the whole world, there are many people, unfortunately, who lose their life in this pandemic. And why is this happening? It is happening because the people do not have the healthy food. They do not have a quality food. They're eating junk food. They're eating the food which is not healthy. And we can also see that our generation is weaker than the previous generations. Those who had pure food in their time, those who were eating the quality food, those who were not eating anything. Today, the industry of food has become the biggest industry. Now, the food is being produced through the industry. It is not the people, it is not the nature that is producing the food. Rather, it is the industry. Therefore, we need to be taking care of ourselves and our generations if we want to have a healthy life, if we want to have a life without trouble. And in the Islamic lifestyle, if we want to reach the perfection, it is necessary to have a quality and healthy food according to the Islamic teachings. Islam talks about healthy food. Islam talks about the pure food. Islam gives importance to all these things. Why? Because the mankind is important. The mankind is what it eats. Therefore, if we want to have a peaceful and a perfect life, it is necessary to have a quality and healthy food, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the UK. As the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs, and the production of fertilizer. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Sarah Butler. The piece is titled, UK Farmers Call for Urgent Action to Prevent Soaring Food Prices. In Britain, farmers are calling for urgent government action to prevent soaring food prices and potential shortages in the United Kingdom as the conflict in Ukraine threatens grain and oilseed harvests, energy costs and the production of fertilizer. The National Farmers Union, NFU, has written to the government warning of multiple compounding factors that have profound implications and risks for our food security, including further pressure on labor costs, as Ukrainian workers have made up about 60% of workers taking up seasonal worker visas to pick and pack produce since the UK left the European Union. It has called for a review of the immigration system to help bring in 10,000 more seasonal workers and for urgent action to prioritize gas for food production and make it easier to use organic fertilizers and manure as an alternative to those produced using fossil fuels. Minette Batters, the president of the National Farmers Union, the NFU, said the conflict in Ukraine had focused attention on the importance and fragility of food security, both here at home and abroad. There are some clear short and long-term actions that government can take to maintain confidence and stability across the UK's food-producing businesses, she said. Minette Batters added, "We have shared these with the government, and we want to stress that we stand ready to take these forward together in order to navigate the extreme volatility we see today and expect to grow in the coming months." While Britain does not import much wheat directly from Ukraine, the country plays a significant part in European food production, and the conflict in Ukraine has forced up food prices across the board. The country also accounts for about 45% of rapeseed, which is imported to the United Kingdom and used to make cooking oil, more than a fifth of maize imports, which are used for animal feed and biofuels, while 80% of sunflower oil comes from the Black Sea region and has been interrupted by the conflict in Ukraine, according to analysts at the UK's Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. The National Farmers Union call for action comes as Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, said it was now running at only half its normal capacity after shutting down two plants in Italy and France this week because of the rising price of gas, a key input to the production process. Gas prices have risen amid the risk of a cutoff in supply from Russia, which produces about 40% of the gas used in Europe. Svein Tore Holsether, the chief executive of Yara, one of the world's largest fertilizer producers, warned that further closures could be on the cards if gas prices continue to rise. As well as potentially affecting the production of fertilizer by the autumn, it could also hit supplies of carbon dioxide, a byproduct of the production process which is used in animal slaughter and food packaging. "Things are changing day by day. We have a lot of uncertainty at the moment, and it is hard to predict going forward, but there is real risk that carbon dioxide will be impacted as a result of this." Meanwhile, pig farmers warned that the industry faced collapse as the soaring grain price only added to existing cost prices on feed and from labour shortages. "The situation is now beyond desperate, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel," said Rob Mutimer, chair of the National Pig Association in Britain. The group has written to retailers asking for an increase in payments to more than £2 per kilogram, more than 50%, or about 70 pence more than is currently being paid. Without the extra payment, the National Pig Association said more farmers would quit the industry, which has suffered months of difficulties. "We're staring down the barrel of a total collapse of the British pig industry, which is not only a tragedy for the producers themselves, but will leave UK consumers short of one of their favourite and most versatile meats," he said. The wheat price now stands in the region of £300 a tonne, compared with about £215 a tonne just a few days ago. Poultry and pork producers are likely to be first to be affected by the rising grain prices, as bakeries and other producers using flour generally pay for their supplies well in advance. The next few weeks are critical for sowing wheat and other crops in Ukraine, which is currently involved in a conflict. Dr. John Rich, the chair of the MHP, one of the country's biggest grain producers, says, "If this continues, of course, our ability to sow rapidly diminishes, particularly if the conflict in Ukraine is prolonged." He said this could lead to complete failure of Ukraine to produce any grain. "The consequences are unimaginable as far as Ukraine is concerned," he said. "For the wider world, it's simple. The price of wheat will continue to rise. The price of corn and other commodities will also rise significantly. And you have spiraling inflation at a time when we already had problems with the global supply chain because of the COVID pandemic," he added.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The most recent example of the fulfillment of these needs is the people's presence in the 22nd of Bahman rally a few days ago. Today's 22nd of Bahman was astonishing. It was really a spontaneous move. It was really a spontaneous movement that people did, and it was really admirable. This move was truly praiseworthy. With the problems that surround the people, the coronavirus and the livelihood problems. On the one hand, the modest slinging of foreigners and the unfortunate contribution of some internal elements to the same mudslinging. On the other hand, and despite all these obstacles and problems, the people held a great rally. Those who record the population of the participants, and who can guess their numbers with cameras, and whose estimation is very close to reality, reported to us that in all but two or three provinces of the country, this year the population was larger than last year. In some provinces, the turnout was twice as much as last year. In some provinces, it was 40-50% more. It was like this everywhere. The people's move showed an astonishing vigilance. These are really admirable and meaningful moves. Well, these are examples of the people's recognition of present-day needs and of their voluntary and innovative moves.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And there are certain issues that form the needs of the future. Many people identify them and carry out the necessary task, and some people show negligence about them. What I mean by future means is the needs that will make us hit rock bottom if we do not think of them and do not do anything for them now. If we do not think of them at present, we will face problems tomorrow. Training scientists and researchers is an example in this regard. If we do not train researchers today, and if we do not launch a great scientific movement, then in 15, 20 years' time, we will no longer have outstanding scientists capable of competing with the world or crossing the frontiers of science.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gilani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act. saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, nightraids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as two-thirds of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the two-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe. So Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the concerned Abuja indigenes said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his 6 sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, What do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja concerned indigent said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of